Well, we've had our show about potatoes, and now on to the next. You know, one of the great things about public radio is 1 hour, you can have a whole hour about potatoes. The next hour, it's urology, and that's what we're doing today on Medical Monday. Support comes from BeFair, providing 24/7 care to persons with disabilities in Berkshire County and the Pioneer Valley. More information on these services at BeFair.org. Joining us today is Dr. Nathan Chertak. Dr. Chertak is an Albany Med Health System urologist who cares for patients with general urological conditions, including kidney stones, voiding dysfunction, bladder, kidney, prostate, and other urological cancers. You got a question? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Nathan Chertak. Dr. Chertak is an Albany Med Health System urologist who cares for patients with general urological conditions, including kidney stones, voiding dysfunction, bladder, kidney, prostate, and other urologic cancers. Dr. Chertak completed residency training in urology at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. He earned his medical degree from Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine in Cleveland, Ohio. He's here today to answer your calls. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. He is a urologist to the stars. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Nathan Chertak, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What's the percentage of the population that's going to get a kidney stone?
It's cited as about 1 in 11 patients will have one in their lifetime. Fortunately, the most common reason for it is that patients don't drink enough water. The number of patients who I see with no other issues, and it's just that their water intake is less than a liter, is astounding. Most patients, the recommendation to avoid getting kidney stones is to drink at least 2.5 liters of water a day.
Interesting.
Or more.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not just about drinking the fluid, it's about making that much urine. So you figure you're in Albany, it's July, you're outside, you're sweating a lot, you're losing more fluid than you realize. You need to keep your fluid intake up even higher than that to be making sure. And usually the summertime is when we see the most incidence of kidney stones because no one's drinking enough water.
Is it possible to have kidney stones and not really know that you have them? Just sort of they go away on their own?
Usually they don't go away on their own. Once they form, it's kind of like in middle school or high school when you did that experiment where you make rock candy in chemistry class where the chemicals kind of precipitate out of solution to form some sort of rock, crystal, or stone. Once they form, it's very, very hard, if not impossible, to get them to dissolve. Some patients can take medication, but that will take months for them to dissolve. So usually I talk to patients, we can either watch them with ultrasounds or we end up talking about taking the stones out before they cause a problem. Or sometimes you just wait until it does cause your problem and then we talk about doing surgery for it.
You can't dissolve them with ultrasound?
So there's a couple different ways that we treat kidney stones surgically, and I think they're all very interesting because it's not what you think of as a typical surgery. One, which is starting to fall out of favor but depends on the urologist you talk to, is shockwave therapy. So you kind of sit in this bathtub in the operating room, and we actually send ultrasound shockwaves through your back, and it pulverizes the kidney stone. You then have to pass the kidney stone on your own.
Ah.
Sometimes we go in with a camera. That's called ureteroscopy. We go up, find the stone, break it up into pieces, and pull it out with a tiny basket. We do use a laser beam, which everyone finds very exciting.
Oh, that's cool.
And then for big stones, you have to go through the back with a bigger camera and break the stones up and suck them out that way.
So that's not just day surgery, right?
A lot of these, you can go home the same day.
Amazing.
Usually the surgery is about an hour. You're asleep the whole time. And then you go home the same day. Sometimes for the bigger surgery, for the bigger stones, you do need to stay overnight. But we're actually moving in the direction where a lot of this is outpatient surgery.
I've not had any kidney stones, knocking wood right now. This shockwave therapy sounds very fascinating. Aren't you concerned that it'll dissolve something else that's good for you in your body?
It is a theoretical concern, but it's been well studied. I mean, the surgery's been performed for thousands, if not millions, of patients, so it's very safe. All of these surgeries are very safe. Of course, any surgery does have risks, and if you are talking to a urologist or any physician about surgical options, definitely discussing those risks and benefits beforehand is a great idea. But I'm a big fan, personally, of the ureteroscopy. I think going up with the camera, being able to get the stones out in one go is kind of the best option. Of course, that does have risk too, but I think it works well. And one of my favorite things about it is you go through the hole that you pee through, so there's no incisions whatsoever.
You know, I've heard, of course, the conventional folk wisdom is, you got a kidney stone, you just slam down some cranberry juice. Is that true?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh.
It is. Patients always ask about water, and some patients do ask about whether they can just have a six-pack of beer and be set.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. Usually, your other kidney that's not getting blocked by a kidney stone just picks up the slack and just sends the urine on its way while the kidney stone just kind of sits there.
Let me ask you an evolutionary question. Why do you think we have two kidneys?
Because there wasn't enough room for three.
Some people have three.
It's a little bit not super common. I would say evolutionarily, I think it's kind of how the human body and other animals evolve. So I think that you see a lot of symmetry. But the great thing is that you can live a completely normal life with one kidney.
Right.
We have plenty of patients who are born with one kidney. And then, unfortunately, we do have to remove some kidneys with surgery, either for cancer, infections, or other reason. And patients are able to live a completely normal life. So I guess if you do have three kidneys, you've got a backup to your backup.
Now, is that tough surgery, removing a kidney?
It can be. It's not the easiest. There are a couple ways to do it. Of course, the term we use is open surgery, where you go through a single incision.
Yeah.
I think the surgery that people are familiar with is removing an appendix, which is often done through three small incisions. We can use that sort of surgery for kidneys, where we make a few small incisions. We go in with a camera and instruments. So no one's actually sticking their hands into the body to get the kidney out. And we're able to remove the kidney this way. A lot of surgeons perform kidney surgery, prostate surgery, bladder surgery, what we call laparoscopic or robotically.
We're joined today by Dr. Nathan Chertak from Albany Meds. Urology on tap today. 800-348-2551 is the number. How about a couple of emails here before we take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. This is from Debbie. Debbie says, I have all the symptoms of a urinary tract infection, but the cultures come back negative. The doctor feels I have interstitial cystitis. Because it's not an infection, antibiotics are not relieving the symptoms. Is this something that I will be dealing with for the rest of my life? Does it ever go away? Needless to say, I'm very uncomfortable. And that's from Debbie.
Debbie, thank you for that question. It's one I hear very often in clinic, both from men and women. It's hard to say, of course, without performing a thorough history and exam, but there are a number of reasons why you can have UTI symptoms without the setting of a UTI. I think your doctor's already taken the first step, which is checking a urine culture to make sure it is not a true infection. There are a few reasons why specifically women can have UTI symptoms. One of them that we see is when women go through menopause, there are some changes in the pelvis and the vaginal area that can cause irritation. This is actually easily treated with vaginal estrogen cream. Another issue that comes up very frequently that we see in both men and women is actually there are a number of muscles in the pelvis that can replicate symptoms of a UTI that can also cause issues with sexual function, issues with bowel function. And actually, the recommended treatment for this is physical therapy.
Uh-huh.
So there are specific physical therapists who do have extra training in pelvic floor physical therapy. And so many of my patients who we've ruled out concerning things, whether that's infections, cancer, kidney stones, obstructing prostate symptoms, oftentimes it's actually the pelvic floor muscles that are causing the issue. And this is actually a very underdiagnosed issue. So usually before I give a patient the label of interstitial cystitis, I usually have them see a physical therapist for a round of physical therapy to rule that out. And many patients do derive a benefit from that.
We're joined by Dr. Nathan Chertak today. It's urology, and this one is from Matt. Could you please explain what the UroLift procedure entails? How successful is it, and what are the pros and cons? And that is from Matt.
Matt, that's an excellent question. So I see many men who come in for urinary issues, and this is probably the number one reason I see patients. I talk to patients about kind of three treatment categories for urinary symptoms. So you can think of one of them is behavioral changes, like things you can do in your daily routine, whether that's going to the bathroom more frequently, setting an alarm, watching how much coffee you drink or other bladder irritants, things like that. Category number two is medications. There's a number of medications that have different benefits and work different ways to help unobstruct the prostate, which is usually the most common cause of these symptoms. And then the third option is surgery. Now, usually we perform a couple of tests to confirm that it is truly obstruction from the prostate causing these symptoms, and make sure that it's not something else that's causing your symptoms. And there are a number of surgery options out there, depending on what I tell all of my patients. If you talk to 10 different urologists, they'll give you 10 different recommendations as to which surgery is going to be the best option for you. Here at Albany Med, we have three different surgeries that are performed most commonly. We have the transurethral resection of the prostate, or TURP, which many patients refer to as the Roto-Rooter procedure. We have a procedure that uses a laser to vaporize the prostate. And then we have the UroLift procedure. There are different risks and benefits that I talk to patients about, and we kind of weigh which one is best for which patient. The UroLift procedure is the least invasive option. What it does, I describe it as the little plastic tag you see when you buy a shirt or a pair of pants at the store that you always have to cut off. It looks like that, but it's actually a little metallic clip that we put on the inside that helps separate or peel the walls of the prostate away from each other to unobstruct the channel that you pee through. This surgery is an outpatient procedure, doesn't require a catheter, and the benefit is that many of the other surgeries we perform have a very strange side effect called retrograde ejaculation, which means when you ejaculate, no semen actually comes out the end of the penis. The UroLift procedure, the main benefit is that it does not have this risk. However, in my opinion and many other urologists, the UroLift procedure is thought to not have as much long-term benefit compared to some of the other treatments, so that is kind of a risk that you have to take with it.
Has laser technology been a game changer for your line of work?
Yes, in a number of ways. We use it mainly for stones, and we use it mainly for prostate issues. So as I mentioned before, we can use it to break up kidney stones, either to fragment it and pull the pieces out with a basket, or we can actually do what's called dusting, where we turn the stone into dust, and then it just washes out in the urine. We can also use it, like I said, to actually vaporize the prostate tissue so that it completely disappears, or we can use it to cut through the prostate tissue and then remove the prostate as a whole.
We have to take a break, but and I don't want to get too far in the weeds here. When you have a laser, how do you make it stop at the bad stuff and not go beyond that into the good stuff?
Practice. A lot of practice.
That's all there is to it?
A lot of practice. Practice makes perfect in this case.
I sense you're simplifying the answer, but we're going to take a break here and leave it there. Dr. Nathan Chertak is our guest. We are talking urology on this edition of Medical Monday. A couple more emails, then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551. Booker T and the MGs here on Vox Pop. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. That's 1-800-348-2551 if you want to talk urology with Dr. Nathan Chertak of Albany Med. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This one's from Anonymous. Anonymous writes, I was wondering if you could explain a bit about penile plaque symptoms, causes, treatments. I'm guessing floss doesn't work on this, right?
Unfortunately, no. Different kind of
plaque. All right, so why don't you answer that one, and then we'll move on.
So we see a number of patients for what we call men's health. You could call it male sexual concerns. And one of these conditions is referred to as Peyronie disease, which is where you form scar tissue in the part of the penis that provides an erection. So you can imagine the penis has two almost water balloons inside it that provide an erection. And if someone was pinching off part of this water balloon, not only would the water balloon not fully expand, but it would also cause it to curve in the direction that it's being pinched off. Now, unfortunately, we don't know why some guys get this and some guys don't. Usually it presents with a noticeable curvature that was not present previously. It can often cause pain. It's usually self-limited. What I mean by that, the curvature doesn't go away 100%. But usually the painful portion of what we call the active phase lasts for anywhere from 6 to 12 months, and usually the plaque stabilizes. Unfortunately, this requires a number of treatments. You will read about a number of things online. Some of those have benefits. Some of those have more questionable benefit. The treatment options that do tend to work are not usually pills. There is medication that can be injected directly into the plaque. This is, you have to make sure, discuss with your doctor whether you're the right patient for this. You may have seen the bent carrot advertisements on online or on TV. So that's that treatment. And then there are a couple of surgical treatments, which, depending on the patient, may be right for you.
You know, when I was a kid, there were not medical ads for drugs on TV, you know, except for the usual over-the-counter stuff. And so now I got to explain to my kids what the bent carrot is supposed to mean, and it's annoying.
Just raising awareness.
All right, fair enough. This question from Susan in Greenfield. What is or what causes bladder prolapse? And that's from Susan in Greenfield.
That's an excellent question. So bladder prolapse. So prolapse is something where if you think about the vaginal cavity as a potential space, and you have the bladder in front of the vagina, you have the rectum behind the vagina, and then you have the uterus and all of your other abdominal organs above the vagina. Now, the vagina is supported by a number of ligaments within the pelvis and the abdomen to kind of support all of this and prevent this potential space from bulging outwards. Unfortunately, with childbirth, with age, with weight gain, many other risk factors, these ligaments can be weakened, and any part of this compartment, the front, the back, or the top, can kind of bulge inwards. So many patients have what we call bladder prolapse, or the medical term is anterior prolapse, which is more generalizable, is where the bladder or that front wall of the vagina bulges forward. Many patients will say that they feel something bulge out when they use the bathroom. Sometimes they have to put that bulge back in. This can be treated. There's many physicians in the Albany Med Health System who treat this condition. There are a number of surgeries that can be performed. You need to talk to your doctor to see whether you'd be a good candidate for one of these surgeries. And it can also be treated with non-surgical options, such as a pessary, which helps kind of support the vagina and hold everything in place.
So a pessary is like some sort of a screening?
It's pessary, you can sort of see like a little, it's almost like a little plastic disc or a cube. There's a number of different ways that it looks. It looks like something out of like a children's play box of blocks. That they have a lot of interesting shapes. But you place it into the vagina, and it's able to support the tissue. It can also be used for patients who do have leakage, which is also caused for similar issues often seen after pregnancy with aging and any other number of issues.
All right. This is from LJ and Latham, and then we will hit the phones and go back to the emails later. Dr. Nathan Chertak joins us from Albany Med. It's urology, if you haven't figured that out. The number is 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. LJ and Latham writes, I have an enlarged prostate, which causes erratic frequency of urination. I'm already on psilocybin to control the frequency. How do I balance the prescribed 1 to 2 liters of water with the frequency to urinate?
So it can be a number of things. This is something to definitely talk to your urologist about, and this is something that I have to talk to my patients about. Of course, I want you to manage the voiding. Or manage the good fluid intake, but of course, yes, it can cause issues with voiding. So number one, I say drink your fluids but during the day, but stop a couple hours before bed, because of course, the important thing to keep in mind, whatever you drink within 3 hours of bed, if you don't pee it out before bed, you're going to end up waking up in the middle of the night and having to make a trip to the bathroom. Number two, it can kind of depend. Sometimes patients are not getting their full bladder volume. What I mean by that is they have their bladder will make them run to the bathroom before they are fully full. And so they never really get to that point. So whereas one patient might only make 6 trips to the bathroom drinking the same amount of water, another patient might be making anywhere from 10 to 15 trips to the bathroom. The other thing is I usually mention to patients, if you're on medications and you are still having a lot of bothersome symptoms, in all honesty, this is a reason to consider surgical options. And I say this as someone who does the surgeries, but the thing that we often see is patients who have kind of been limping along on medications, been avoiding surgery, they're scared of surgery for one reason or another, and it reaches the point where their bladder kind of reaches the point of no return, where it goes from too frequent urination to not frequent enough because the bladder is no longer able to squeeze out urine past the prostate. So I usually talk to patients that I see in clinic and I say, if you're on medication, if the medication isn't working well for you, let's look into more invasive treatment options that can potentially help you as opposed to more medication, which I look at as putting a Band-Aid on the problem.
Dr. Nathan Chertak joins us today. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll begin in Saratoga. Douglas, you're on.
Hey, Ray, per usual, thank you very much your timely show and your really amazing guests.
Thank you.
My question to the doctor is kind of twofold. His general feeling about the accuracy of the PSA exam for prostate issues. And then on the consumer basis, alcohol use, caffeine use, et cetera, related to prostate inflammation, blah, blah, blah.
Excellent question, Douglas. So I'll give you a little bit of my prostate cancer spiel the first time I meet a patient. So prostate cancer is a tricky disease in that it's not the easiest to screen for. Looking big picture, prostate cancer, of course, is a cancer, and cancer is scary. But unlike some other cancers, which when you get diagnosed, unfortunately, we're talking about a life expectancy of a few months to a couple of years, prostate cancer for most patients, and there are plenty of exceptions, for most patients, if we diagnose prostate cancer, we just watch it. We don't do anything about it. Many patients, the prostate cancer will take 10 to 20 years for it to spread, lead to symptoms, and then unfortunately lead to death. Oftentimes before this point, it doesn't cause any symptoms. So the trade-off is we're trying to find concerning prostate cancer before patients develop symptoms. The way we do this, the easiest way to screen for prostate cancer is with the PSA test. The PSA test is very good. This is testing for a chemical that's in the blood. The chemical is only produced by your prostate, hence the acronym prostate-specific antigen. The problem is the PSA can be elevated because you have prostate cancer, but it can also be elevated because your prostate is abnormally large. It can be elevated because you have a history of inflammation, infections. So it's not a specific test, although it's specific to the prostate, but usually I talk to patients and say, this is the first step. Depending on your PSA level, let's talk about other test options, whether that's biomarkers, whether that's an MRI. And then for many patients, they have to go on to undergo a prostate biopsy to help actually diagnose cancer. But I try to individualize this pathway. Even though this is an extremely common disease, it's still not something where every patient fits the same pathway. We have to do different treatment options and different workups for different patients. The second question was...
Douglas, why don't you reiterate?
Alcohol, caffeine use recommendations.
That's an excellent question as well. So this has been extensively studied. Prostate cancer is one of the most common cancers that we see in medicine in general. But as of right now, there's not any good evidence that's saying things will increase or decrease your risk for prostate cancer. Smoking, which is the most common risk factor for many cancers, has not been proven to be a risk factor for prostate cancer. So have many other things. So the recommendation that I make to my patients is honestly just healthy lifestyle. So making sure to eat healthy, exercise regularly, minimize smoking if you do, alcohol in moderation, caffeine in moderation, and try to keep in touch with your primary care doctor and your urologist.
Douglas, thanks a lot for the call. It's Medical Monday today. Dr. Nathan Chertak joins us from Albany Med. And the number is 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Into Hudson we go. David, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I have prostate cancer. I have a PSA of went from 51 to 78 in 3 weeks. Gleason 9, PRAD 5. I finished 40 days of radiation a year ago, January. I've been on four different urination medicines, and I'm still having issues, and I just wonder if this is just going to be like it for the rest of my life. I'm 70 years old.
Okay.
Well, David, I'm sorry to hear about everything that you've been going through, and unfortunately this is not an infrequent issue that we see. Radiation, although it does have wonderful effects for treatment of prostate cancer, unfortunately, we do see patients who have side effects from the radiation treatment, and it kind of unmasks some of the symptoms that patients would have from their prostate to begin with, which is unrelated necessarily to the cancer they had from the start. I would definitely speak to your urologist about possible options. There are a variety of options. There are medications out there. Sometimes we are able to talk about surgical options. It kind of depends, again, on the risks and benefits of each treatment option, whether it's medications for the rest of your life, what the risks of the surgery would be, especially after radiation. But it's definitely it's individualized to each patient and kind of what they've gone through.
David.
Right. Okay. I mean, my concern is that this is my life, and I have to get used to it, and it is what it is. But
it's not easy. I would definitely recommend emphasizing to your physician how much of an impact this is having on your quality of life. I think one of the benefits of being a urologist is that we get to both help patients with issues such as cancer, kidney stones that have a big impact on their quantity of life, but also discuss things such as urinary issues, voiding symptoms that, although at the end of the day, are not necessarily going to kill us, but they do have a huge impact on kind of how much we're able to enjoy our day-to-day life.
David, thanks a lot for the call. It's our Medical Monday today, because it's Monday. Dr. Nathan Chertak joins us from Albany Med. Urology is the topic. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Hi. Thank you, doctor. Thank you, Ray.
You bet.
Is there a test that will discriminate life-threatening from non-life-threatening prostate cancer? Latter is very common. Life-threatening prostate cancer is almost as prevalent as breast cancer, but gets much less attention. I see a report from Harvard Medical School, new urine test may help some men with elevated PSA avoid biopsy. But is there a test that will discriminate the life-threatening from not? Thanks.
The short answer, unfortunately, is no. I wish I could say that we do have one test, but unfortunately, there's no perfect test. The PSA test is good, but it's not perfect. This is why every urologist has different preferences in terms of what tests they use, but there are different tests out there that we combine together to kind of give us an answer. My usual pathway that I work with most patients is we check a PSA, maybe check a rectal exam, and then usually I try to get an MRI. I think this provides the most information as to the presence or absence of prostate cancer, but none of this is guaranteed. Even a prostate biopsy is not 100% accurate, unfortunately. We do have patients who undergo a biopsy and we don't find cancer the first time around. But I would talk to your doctor. There's different urologists have different opinions. There are new biomarker tests. What this means, it's a more accurate test, either using chemicals that are found in the urine or in the blood to give an estimate as to your prostate cancer risk. But at the end of the day, these are just estimates, and we can't guarantee based on one test alone whether or not a cancer is life-threatening. So I would definitely have a conversation with your urologist about what options are available for you.
Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, one more call here before the next break. Then we'll check the email bag really quickly and back to the phones. Our number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Nathan Chertak from Albany Med, the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go to Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
What is the most likely cause of multi-streams of urine other than a tumor in the meatus or stone?
Excellent question, Jim. There can be a number of causes. It can be because the hole at the end of the urethra, which is referred to as the meatus, it can be too small. And so you can kind of think of it like putting your finger over a garden hose and you see the spraying of the stream. Sometimes this is because there's some scar tissue or an obstruction farther into the urethra. This is what we refer to as a urethral stricture or scarring. And sometimes patients who do have obstructing prostate tissue can also report a spraying of the stream. Usually the best test we recommend to figure out what's going on is called cystoscopy. This is where we insert a camera into the urethra. Usually we do this in clinic. I tell all my patients this is no one's favorite thing, but we'll get you through it. It takes about 2 to 5 minutes, and it gives us a good look at what the internal anatomy is. It gives us a look at the bladder, the prostate, of the urethra, and usually we're able to diagnose 80 to 90% of causes based on from this test alone.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll take a quick break here. Dr. Nathan Chertak is our guest from Albany Med Health System. The number is 800-348-2551. Email's voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back. Crusaders, so far away here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Dr. Nathan Chertak of Albany Med. Let's do a couple of emails here at voxpop@wamc.org, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from, I don't know who it's from, and we'll say anonymous. Anonymous writes, my husband often gets lightheaded when urinating. Recently, he actually blacked out while urinating. Is it possibly related to his urinary tract or just a coincidence? He's an active person who sights and stands often without any lightheadedness.
I would say that's an interesting question. So when we start to see kind of signs and symptoms outside of the urinary tract, like getting lightheaded when urinating, these start to make us concerned about something else going on. As a urologist, I like to think I have the most important job in the hospital, but I know that's not true. Many of the other specialists, whether it's heart doctors, lung doctors, intensive care, you name it, can be much more helpful in this sort of situation. I would definitely talk to your husband's primary care doctor about this. I think there may be something else going on besides the urinary tract that may be leading to this problem that he should definitely get checked out.
All right, this is from Jay in Lenox. I'm a 73-year-old woman who all my life had a large urine capacity. Over the past few years, I have developed incontinence to the point that when I realize I need to urinate, it comes immediately. I always assumed this happened to women who had children, which I never have. When this problem began, I told my new primary doctor. He told me to do Kegels. Kegels hasn't worked, and the problem is worse. Please advise what type of medical treatment and practitioner I should consult. That's from Jay in Lenox.
Jay, thanks for the excellent question. So there can be a number of things going on here. So when I take care of adult patients. I don't take care of children. But when we are doing our training, we spend a lot of time taking care of kids. And one of the things we see a lot of kids with is what's called voiding dysfunction. So we all go through potty training. And some kids don't take to potty training as easily as many others do, and they have trouble either with holding behaviors, constipation, bedwetting, you name it. Many of these issues can be fixed by the pediatrician, by a pediatric urologist, but we do see many patients who never kind of outgrow some of these issues, like we'd call infrequent voiding. And as they go through adulthood, no one really points out that, hey, maybe there's something going on here, and the problem slowly gets worse over time. Something that we can see is what's called overflow incontinence, where the bladder gets so full. I describe it to patients. It's almost like there's a dam, and the dam is full, and you only see a little bit of water that leaks over the dam. So you think it's a little trickle, but there's actually the dam is full. So I would actually talk to a urologist and make sure that you're emptying your bladder adequately. One of the other things I recommend to patients so that their bladder doesn't get too full is not infrequent voiding, but what we call time voiding. So making sure that even if you don't have a strong urge to void, you're going to the bathroom every couple of hours and making sure that you try to empty out whatever's in your bladder.
All right. One more email for now, and then we'll go back to the phones. We'll try to hit the emails again later. This one's from John. Is burst wave lithotripsy more common now? First, tell me what that is.
So that's not something I will admit to be overly familiar with. There's a number of tools that have been used historically and are being actively developed, and some of these tools that were historic are kind of being revamped and reutilized. There were a number of tools that were used and are used when we go through, when we perform something called a percutaneous nephrolithotomy, there's a number of tools. We've talked about the laser already.
Yeah.
We use this ultrasonic shockwave device that actually pulverizes and then suctions out the stones. So there are also hydraulic devices that kind of just hammer the stone, break it into pieces, and then can be suctioned out. So I am not familiar with the burst wave device, but it's definitely something I would look into. I would discuss with your urologist if interested.
Let's go back to our phone lines now with Dr. Nathan Chertak, 800-348-2551, to Rhinebeck. Priscilla, you're on.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have what is called a neurogenic bladder because I have MS, and the brain messaging to the muscles and nerves that control urination are out of whack. I've been on many pills. I still take two, Mirbetriq and oxybutynin. I have an interstim implant, and I have had Botox injections into the bladder wall. None of it works, really. If I stopped everything, I probably wouldn't leave the house, but I still go through about $150 worth of disposable panties every month, and I just wondered if you know of anything that's being worked on for this type of bladder problem.
So, Priscilla, I'm really sorry about everything that you're going through. It sounds like it's a really difficult situation. The short answer is, unfortunately, no. I can't think of anything offhand, but here's why. As we've mentioned, I'm a general urologist, and I did training in urology, but many of my colleagues go on to do an extra 1 to 2 years of training, whether that's in cancer, kidney stones, or complex voiding dysfunction, incontinence, women's health, women's reconstructive surgery, or what we call neurourology. At this point, since you're on medications, you've undergone surgeries, you've tried all of these different treatment options, if I was seeing you in clinic, I would actually probably recommend seeing one of my colleagues who specializes in complex voiding dysfunction or neurogenic bladder to see what other options are out there and potentially what can be considered for you.
Priscilla.
Thank you very, very much. I'll get in touch with your hospital. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Nathan Chertak joins us today. 800-348-2551 is our number. To New York City. Mark, you're on.
Hello, doctor. So I have moderate BPH, and my doctor has recommended that I try a treatment called Rezum, R-E-Z-U-M, which is with, I'm sure you're aware of this, steam cleaning. I was wondering what your thoughts were about that.
So it's an excellent question. As I mentioned earlier, if you are talking to 10 different urologists about surgical treatment for BPH or enlarged prostate, you'll get 10 different answers. The Rezum is something that I am familiar with the concept. I have not personally performed it. I think it's right for the properly selected patient, but of course you have to be the properly selected patient. At the end of the day, I think, in my opinion is, I think getting an opinion from a urologist is a great idea. And if my patients ask me about procedures that I don't perform, I try to find someone who is available or point them in a different direction. And I leave it up to them because at the end of the day, it's your urinary function and your voiding. But if you're looking for other options, I don't think it's unreasonable to get a second opinion. But I think, again, at the end of the day, it is the right surgery for the right patient.
Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it very much. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Nathan Chertak from Albany Med joins us today. And we go to Plattsburgh. And John, you're on.
The Rezum is something that
Hello? John? Zach, you potted him down. Are you there, John?
Of course you have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, I apologize to John in Plattsburgh, but that's the way it goes in the big-time showbiz. Tom in West Hampton, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I've been diagnosed with a large staghorn kidney stone in one of my kidneys. The Hounsfield measurement is approximately 450. My dad had gout. So the urologist says it's probably either cystine stone or uric acid stone, cystine being extremely rare. He's put me on a treatment for uric acid, 2 times 15 MEQ, potassium citrate, and 300 allopurinol, and of course the diet and lots of drinking. So we're kind of hanging our hat on that Hounsfield measurement, I guess, and my dad's history. I was wondering if this diagnosis sounds reasonable. And also, while I'm in the dissolving process, I'm not seeing any kidney stone fragments in my urine, although I am seeing a lot of mucus. And I was wondering if that was typical. Thank you.
So, Tom, it's an excellent question. Like I tell all of my patients, I will never try to step on one of my colleagues' toes, so I can't necessarily comment on your specific treatment plan, especially without looking at the imaging. But I appreciate you letting us know about the Hounsfield units. For those of you who are not in the know about the Hounsfield units, this is a measurement of how dense a kidney stone is on imaging. We mentioned earlier that occasionally kidney stones can be dissolved. Usually these are stones with the Hounsfield units of less than 500, indicating that they are less dense. As I mentioned before, this can often take months to dissolve. You don't necessarily see bits of stone that pass in the urine. It's more that the stone slowly dissolves over time, almost like dissolving a sugar cube back into water. Patients, I would talk to them about potentially dissolving the stone with a couple different medications, but also for very large stones, usually I recommend the fastest and quickest way. Of course, this does have risk, would be surgery. But that would be something I would bring up with your urologist.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot. What is actually comprising a kidney stone? What is it?
It's a great question. So the majority of patients have a very unexciting formulation, which is calcium oxalate. Oxalate's something the average person doesn't really think about, but it's something we think about very often in urology. This is a chemical that compounds with calcium to precipitate out to form crystals in the urine. So about 90%, 80 to 90% of patients have some sort of calcium oxalate stone. Next most common kind is uric acid, which is formed through a little bit different mechanism. This is when the urine is usually too acidic. So the easiest way to dissolve these stones or to prevent them from happening is making the urine less acidic. Again, going way back to high school chemistry class. There are more rare types of stones. You can actually get bacteria that produce a chemical or an enzyme that causes stones to quickly form. I've seen patients form stones over weeks to a month or two, whereas most stones take months to years to form. And then you do see, he brought up cysteine, which is a genetic condition where patients tend to be frequent kidney stone formers. Unfortunately for those patients, they have to drink anywhere from 3 to 4 liters or more daily. They have to try their best to alkalinize the urine, avoid it from becoming too acidic. And there are some medications that they can take, but oftentimes these patients are frequent visitors to our stone clinics and to the operating room to unfortunately remove recurrent kidney stones.
If somebody has gout, are they more likely to have the uric acid variety of kidney stones?
It's a good question. So the tricky thing, and this is what we always get tested on, is when a patient has uric acid stones, usually it can be from gout, it can be from other things, but the best way to get it out of solution is to make the urine less acidic. Patients with gout can also form calcium oxalate stones. It's actually just like if you're making rock candy, where you dangle a string or a wooden rod to act as a nidus to form the crystal. The uric acid oftentimes forms a small crystal, but then the calcium oxalate forms the major stone around the uric acid, so it's kind of a combination. Mm. But for our patients who have gout, who have elevated uric acid levels in their blood and then form calcium oxalate stones, those are the patients who we often recommend allopurinol for.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Nathan Chertak joins us from Albany Med. And let's see here. We'll go now to, we'll go to Catskill. And Ed, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I have a quick question, an old age question. I just realized that I'm 77, mm-hmm. and I haven't had a PSA test in years. I guess that's the standard, but why?
So that's an excellent question, Ed. So like I mentioned before, prostate cancer from the time of diagnosis can take anywhere from 10 to 20 years for it to cause problems for you. So if you're 77 and we find prostate cancer now, the honest conversation that I have many days in my clinic is something else is going to get you before this prostate cancer does, just based on probability. It's the unfortunate truth. So at some point, it becomes less beneficial to screen patients for prostate cancer, and at that point, we hold off on PSA check. Now, certain patients are recommended to continue PSA screening beyond the age of 70 or 75. This kind of depends on your prior PSAs. Other patients who have a PSA that's considered to be within the normal limits, between 0 to 3, usually by around the age of 75, the chance that those patients would develop concerning prostate cancer is so low that screening is no longer recommended. But it's very individualized.
Ed.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. Along those lines, we had an email from Andrew. How often should you get a PSA test?
So that's a really good question. So this is constantly evolving. We have many specialties in medicine use what's called guidelines, which are a combination of all the research studies that have been done throughout the past years combined together to make strong recommendations. Now, these are all recommendations, and at the end of the day, these are rules that can be bent, not necessarily potentially broken. So they're constantly updating the PSA recommendations. And to kind of get into the weeds a little bit, the USPSTF, which is the National kind of Preventative Medicine Guidelines, have given PSA screening a grade of C, which means it's not recommended for all patients.
Huh.
It's not recommended for patients, but it's more of an individual discussion for patients. So the PSA test, it kind of depends. Some people talk to all their patients about it. Some people talk to none of their patients about it. Sometimes I'm the first one having this conversation with the patient. So it kind of depends. But depending on what your PSA comes back as, it's recommended to be checked annually. But for many patients who are in their 50s or 60s, if their PSA is less than 1, again, the chances that you develop prostate cancer in your lifetime, plus the fact that prostate cancer is so slow growing, that it's often safe to just check a PSA every 2 to 4 years. But again, this can be discussed with your doctor.
All right, let's grab a call or two here before we wrap it up with Dr. Nathan Chertak. We'll go to Great Barrington. And Jake, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm 74, and I saw a urologist about a year ago because I had some urination problems, very mild ones. And he diagnosed me with benign prostatic hyperplasia. He recommended a medication, which I did not take. It was Alfuzol, I believe was the name, because my symptoms went away. I recently had bloods drawn, and my PSA came back at 2.35. and was flagged by the lab as high, as a result of which the lab included three measures I'd never seen: precursor PSA isoform, or P2 PSA, pre-prostate specific antigen, and a prostate health index, none of which are shown or flagged as high. I've never seen those measurements before. According to the index, I'm in the 33% category of something. I'm not sure what that means. And yet, having a PSA of 2.35 does not seem to be unhealthy for my age of 74. So should I be worried about this condition is my primary question. And then I have a secondary one if you have time for it.
We may not get to that, but let's go with number one right now.
So, okay. Jake, I would say, long story short, I would say a PSA of in the twos at your age is not overly concerning. Different labs have different cutoffs, so I'm not sure the specifics there. But it's definitely something I would review the results with your primary care doctor or your urologist just to kind of make sure that there's nothing else that you should be concerned about. Sometimes this is kind of gets your foot in the door and we find other things that are going on, or it's just nice to have some reassurance.
All right, now, Jake, you have 12 seconds to pose question two.
What do you think of the studies that have been done about acupuncture and yoga as a treatment for enlarged prostate?
That's an excellent question. So I think depending on the urologist that you talk to, different urologists feel differently about complementary and alternative medicine, which I would say those would fall into the category of. I think overall the evidence for them is not strong. I would use the term maybe weak for some of them. At the end of the day, ultimately, I don't think there's any harm to these treatments. as long as you discuss them with your doctor and they're not taking the place for other potentially more beneficial treatments. But at the end of the day, it's your health and it's your decision.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Dr. Nathan Chertak, splendid job today. Great job. We learned a lot and appreciate you being here. Support comes from the Eddy Nursing Homes. Open houses at all 6 Eddy skilled nursing facilities this Saturday afternoon for families considering a nursing home for a loved one. Eddy, E-D-D-Y, nursinghomes.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Nathan Chertak of Albany Medical Center for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. We got so many of them. I apologize to everybody who didn't get their call in or didn't get their email in. Trust me, we will do this topic again. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathbun screened the call. Wonderful job. Thanks, Bob. Tomorrow. Now, this is a switch. Now, before the show started, we had an hour about potatoes, and then we did an hour about urology. Tomorrow, we'll do an hour about birds with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. It's all about variety here in public radio. Give now.